third day, fourth day of session. And by now, because we've been here the whole time, we've sat maybe 30 periods of Zazen. We've walked, I don't know, I was trying to do the calculation before, 5 to 10 Ks in Kenya. So it's good exercise as well. A lot of that quite quickly. When I was at Zen Mountain Centre in California, I used to think, we walked a lot. Because you do all this Kenhin during session, and then my cabin was about 500 metres from the Zendo. And so, I don't know how many Ks I did, but it was very, very good. And then you're having a vegetarian diet and lots of physical exercise, and it was it's good for the soul. A bit of Zazen. A lot of rock moving. So the chant we just chanted about the Dharma. The Dharma is incomparably profound and infinitely subtle, and it's really rarely encountered, even in millions of ages. And I think that's, I always get surprised that there aren't millions of people doing sesshin. You know, when you kind of swallow the pill and find the amazing life-changing benefits of sitting down. And that's the first time I did acid. Why isn't everybody doing this? It's so life-changing. But there are some sessions kind of a safer and more legal alternative. Something that really kind of shifts the way that you view your life in a particular way. And session is like that. And and we kind of know the ropes. We know how the session is set up. The great container of silence. And the order and the regularity of it. There's obviously the sitting, the zazen, which is a form, the eating, the chanting, this whole container. And it's a very rare thing. And as we recite the names of the lineage in the morning session, we go from the names of the historical Buddhas who are, I guess they're kind of before the Shakyamuni Buddha, the historical Buddha, occurs about number 7. And then before that, there's another 6. And so these are what they're called primordial Buddhas. That's right, they're not historical, primordial Buddhas. And in a certain sense, the kind of indicators that this practice didn't start with Shakyamuni Buddha and doesn't. And then it goes all the way through to Hakuyu Taizan Maizumi, who's the founder of our White Plum lineage, and my teacher's teacher. And there's a huge, debt of gratitude that we owe to all those folks in the past who have handed it down. And it's really encountered, that this Dharma, even though it's complete just as it is, and we're always encountering it just like this all the time. Actually appreciating it is very rare. They say it's like a piece of wood that's floating in the vast ocean. And it's got a knot in it, a small hole. And then once every 1,000 years a turtle surfaces. And the chance of that turtle sticking its head up through that piece of wood is about as much chance as you've got of encountering the Dharma. And yet, here we are. So it's quite a beautiful and rare thing. So cultivating it and paying attention to this basic experience is our mission, and it's both for ourselves. We do it for ourselves, you know, but we also do it for all beings. You know, it's that benefit that you know, we're not just practicing for our own awakening, enlightenment, and self-satisfaction. But this benefit is huge, and there's no, you know, can't really say whether this time is any worse than any other time. But certainly, you know, in our own lives and the lives of all beings on this great earth, you know, encountering the Dharma and transmitting it is really important. So I want to talk a little bit about maybe some little bit of kind of form or approach to Zazen, and some of it's kind of based around this what I call kind of exploration or curiosity. You know, there's a certain kind of inquisitiveness that all Zen students have around what's going on in your life, in the world. You know, we sit here, you know, for 4 days, and certain sense kind of querying our existence. And so that and there's kind of lots of schemas that we use. You know, we use meditation techniques. You know, typically we start off with paying attention to breath. So bringing the mind to a specific point. And the reason we do that is so that we can get a bit of an idea of what's going on with our mind in its regular state. So the kind of thinking process, it shines a light that we're thinking. When you focus on one particular thing, then we start to see that our mind is processing. And so this kind of goes through the various other concentration practices, such as koan or shikantaza, which is kind of a broad awareness. But there's also kind of other ways we can appreciate our mind. I'm just going to go through kind of a 5-step pattern, which might be useful to shine a bit of a light on our patterns of mind. So, and especially it's quite useful when things are coming up that are quite sticky or emotional, the things that are kind of hard to work with. And the first one, around that exploration and curiosity, is that question of like, what is going on right now? You know, what is going on right now? That so if we drop the storyline, what is going on right now? And you see, it's kind of dualistic, and to a certain extent, you're kind of asking yourself, what is happening here? And if it's something that's particularly troubling or challenging, then seeing that appreciation of what is going on right now. So it's a real kind of question, it's like an honest question to yourself, what is going on? And then, if it's something challenging for you, then the next question is, can I see this as my path? Can I see this thing that is going on for me right now as my path? When you say path, it's not like it's separate from your life, but it's like it's the thing that's right in front of you. Your path is the thing that you're walking on. Can I see this thing that is going on right now as my path? You know, and it's kind of not really a question of yes or no. You know, but you know, we instinctively want a life that's problem free. You know, we're always trying to manipulate circumstance so that there's no trouble. And we do it by, you know, withdrawing. I tend to do that, but kind of withdraw, like hide. hope someone else will take care of it. Controlling, you know, so we actually step forward and fix the situation, depending on the personality. Well, there's the blame game, which is another good one. Nothing to do with me. Their issue. And I guess that, you know, but whenever you use those kind of patterns, they always feel a little off. You know, it's like one of those things when you check in with yourself, it's always a bit like, you know, it's not quite right. I know I'm doing something here that just feels a little off. And it never really gives us the quality of life that we want. You know, so can I see this as my path? Whatever's arising now, can I see it as my path? And it's almost like welcoming distress, which seems a bit crazy. Welcome distress. So that story of Milarepa, the great yogi, who had I guess he caused a lot of trouble because he was a black magician, and he killed a lot of people. People didn't like particularly. Maybe they weren't that good, but he caused a whole building to collapse on a wedding party. It wouldn't be very nice to him. And the story about him is he ends up in a mountain cave, and Martha, his master, tells him to head up to the mountains. And while he's there, he gets all the account of all these monsters who want to come and eat him. The story goes on, but eventually he welcomes those challenges in fatigue. So can I see this whatever's coming up as my path? And then next one is kind of like what is my most believed thought? I find this one interesting because when we dig down, when we find a certain kind of sense of resistance or fear, there's usually stuff underneath that. Something that's kind of quite deep. It's whether you call it conditioning but there's usually a set of beliefs there that we uncover during practice. You know, it might be a sense of unworthiness. Oh, I'm unworthy. No, I'm not worthy. Is that Mike Myers? Mm. Okay, catch that illusion? No. Yeah. Haven't seen the movie?
Yeah.
Oh, which one was it? Phil and Ted. No,
it's
Wayne's World. That's right. Alice Cooper turns up, and they're rock. They're all Mike Myers and his friend. I can't remember his name. But I really can't. They run a little radio station, is it? You know, a TV show. Anyway, and Alice Cooper turns up, and of course he's their guru. You know, Google it. Anyway, it'll be on YouTube, and he's like, "Oh, we're not worthy. I'm not worthy." So anyway. Alice Cooper's playing himself as well. So we might feel that we're not worthy, we're not lovable, we can't cope, I won't ever succeed. I was reflecting on at this gathering in the Zen Center, California. We were going around talking about our ages, and I thought everyone's, a lot of people talk about age and that. And but for me, it's a lot of my kind of most believed thought is I won't be able to handle the pressure. In other words, I will crumble if I unless I define clear boundaries to what I can give in terms of energy. And whether it's in family life, work, with the Dharma, And it's quite a believed thought. So it leads to me to a certain kind of stinginess, I think, which is one of the precepts. So what is my most believed thought? And some of that can come around effort too. As I really commit myself to practice, even just to what's in front of me right now during Zazen, then I won't have anything left. I'm going to exhaust myself. So there's some of those little nubs of a belief, and one of the beauties about consistent practice is you start to shine a light and you start to see those most believed thoughts. And when you shine awareness on it, then it gives you information, but they also tend to, it's like Calvin and Hobbes, when you actually look under the bed, because there are monsters there all the time, but when you actually look, in terms of Calvin and Hobbes, they are there, but also they're not, you open the cupboard and then those monsters aren't there. And you shine that light. Another interesting question is total segue. I just think of my kids at night like to have the cupboard doors closed. And to me, it's like, yeah, but then there could be things in the cupboard, So is that thing of do you close the door so they can't get out, or do you open them so you can't see that, so you see that they're there? I've read different personality types too. And then the next kind of question really is really kind of brings to the heart of the matter, what is this? Which is a real kind of one of those standard koans, what is this? Who am I? Beyond thoughts. What is going on right now is a certain kind of questioning. Uses a certain kind of dualistic thinking, but what is this going on right now? What is it that is experiencing this? Being, and this is real kind of curiosity. It's really kind of showing that curiosity. It's real when you start to get to that real kind of shikantaza experience. It's like, just being completely open. What is this? Because you can look at something and go well, there's me experiencing that. But what is it that is experiencing that? And which is really that encouragement to really let go of the question. And it's almost like it's a really formless kind of question. It's a bit of a, it's almost like that universal curiosity. And in a sense, it's also like saying, it's really that opening up to yes. That really opening to experience. And not compartmentalizing it in any way. And then kind of the final one is can I let this experience just be? Which is that real surrender, I talk about faith a bit. But can I let this experience just be? I think it's part of that comes from that, again, this is kind of like not something you just got to whip on through, it's a lifetime practice, but ultimately, I guess we experience that sometimes, usually, it's more painful to push things away, push pain away, than just to feel it. Letting things in really opens up, kind of a sense of spaciousness. begin to kind of recognize that sometimes when those things we do open, then something arises and we kind of tense up again. But that question, like, can I let this experience just be? Do I need to modify it in any way? Which is really the, I guess, kind of the heart of the practice. And especially, you know, during Zazen, we have the opportunity to let this experience just be. It's got a certain kind of quality, I guess, of loving kindness too around that the, you know, requires a requires faith, but also that it's very much kind of like a part of our Soto Zen practice is that real opening a wide container, you know, that reaches to the edges of the universe. You know, so this experience isn't particularly felt by me. You know, can we allow those disowned experiences, you know, things that we normally would push outside, to just be? You know, it's like including everything. You know, and I kind of reflect that that it's a real yes, it's a real affirmation practice, and you know, and it's awfully healing, you know, and empowering to say yes. You know, I kind of still have this memory of when I was in the UK, I think it's whenever it was, years ago, and I was there for 6 months, I think, working. I was quite lonely during that time. I'd just kind of moved there. I'd broken up with my girlfriend. It was like, I remember going to see Sheen and then coming back, and there were a couple of people on the boat who'd been to see Sheen. I remember spending 3 or 4 hours just talking, and then when I got back, I felt awfully good, and I couldn't work out what. It wasn't just see Sheen. It was just that, because I'd been kind of feeling quite isolated, and it was just that, I'm just feeling like so good the next week, and I couldn't work out what it was. And it's like, finally came to me that it was that real feeling of being affirmed. You know, it's like when you're doing a lot of kind of pushing and trying to find work and do all this stuff, and then actually like really being affirmed. And it was just that a couple of hours of therapy. It wasn't even therapy, it was just chatting. You know, on the ferry coming back from Calais, I think, to Dover. And I still remember that to that day, that sense of affirmation and just how healing it is to be accepted, you know. And so I think it's part of the part of our practice of acceptance and letting those experiences, you know, just be. It's very like that. Also think of the whose voice? Where are the sirens? The sirens are. Who was in the boat? Classical scholars.
Ulysses.
Yeah.
Odysseus.
Anyway.
I think it's Odysseus.
Okay. Yeah. And then the does anyone know the story of the sirens? So they're, I guess, mermaids that are sitting on the rocks in one of the great trials, and they draw the sailors to their doom. And so then the sailors, the ships pass by, the sirens, these beautiful women are singing out, and the sailors like being out in the sea forever, you know, they're kind of all, I think they've got sharp teeth or something, but anyway, things don't end well. And so imagine is like, you know, it's some way it sounds like it was like, you know, sexual attraction, but you know, I kind of really imagine that song of the siren to be you know, just imagine that, you know, someone was willing to totally accept you for what you were. Absolutely no holds barred, you know, it's like all your kind of warts and insecurities and whatever it was, and you've been out on the sea for a, you know, a very long time, struggling through all kinds of trials and tribulations, and then there's this kind of this call, the siren call. It's like, you know, it's like that healing doesn't end well for them, but maybe it does. I don't know.
Well, it just says straps himself to the mast, doesn't he? He gets strapped to the mast. So you should have been strapped to the mast somewhere rather than have that chat.
Yes.
And all the other sailors plank their ears with wax.
That's right.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Yeah, it's an interesting kind of myth there. Yeah. That's what we typically do, you know. But I think that's what I kind of like that, actually, to kind of go beyond that these sirens are bad, actually. You know, it's that imagine. Yeah, imagine. Imagine having that much love. It's like it's irresistible. Irresistible. You know. If you'd really, you know, be that open, that would draw people, you know, all your kind of worries and would be laid to rest.
And then you get chewed to bits by the...
In the nicest possible way.
I think there's another myth that might work better for that one.
I don't know, I kind of like, because there's a song of the siren. Who wrote that one? Is it Ian Yarra or someone like that? Mm-hmm.
I think it isn't. No, Susan Vega.
Who is that?
Susan Vega. Is this Calypso? Though. It's
probably it could be. Yeah. Anyway.
Didn't capture somebody too.
Yeah.
But the Miller Roper one though, definitely, isn't it? He's inviting all this into, and they they're transformed, aren't they?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Sorry, finish your thought. So you've got these beautiful things that are so enticing and amazing, total acceptance.
Yeah, it's all illusions break down, don't they? But I guess I just think that total kind of acceptance. It's like, I guess it's not, you know, it's kind of like parental love, although parental love breaks down when you're really stressed too. But really being open, and that's what we're cultivating, that kind of widening of that and accepting everything. Like the great ocean, it says, you know, accepts all rivers in there. And so that's what I mean. So, you know, that and that affirmation that I find is awfully healing and empowering. So this kind of schema was elucidated by Ezra Bader. He's a successor Joko Beck, who's in our lineage. And he says that, says something quite nice. You might read what he says about the this path around his own, one of his own challenges. So he interestingly, Ezra Bader, he was a successor of Joko Beck, and he went with his family, went to live the good life and go live on an organic farm, and they, and while he was there, you know, they're doing all the right things and eating really well and exercising, and then he got sicker and sicker and sicker and couldn't work out what it was. But finally they started testing the soil and found that the soil was heavily polluted. And it had been a dump. But, so, you know, he ended up with all these pretty nasty, nasty health conditions. He said, recently I was told that I had to have a particularly unpleasant medical procedure. Combined with the fear around the thought of having a procedure were the memories of painful experiences of prior similar medical procedures, leading to a feeling of dread and morbidity. Over the years, I've become free from many of my fears and attachments, but each of us has our own particular edge, that place beyond which fear tells us not to go. So even though I had extensive experience practicing with illness and pain, there was no doubt that this particular set of circumstances put me at my personal edge. It was helpful to ask the first question, what is going on right now? Because that enabled me to see that there was actually no physical discomfort other than the discomfort triggered by believing my fear-based thoughts. It was also helpful to ask, can I see this situation as my path? Pointing to the opportunity to work with my own particular attachments and fears, as well as asking, what are my most believed thoughts? Which allowed me to see that the thoughts such as, this is too much, and I can't do this, were just thoughts. Thoughts that were not the truth, no matter how accurate they felt in the moment. But the real key to working with the panic and dread came from answering the question, what is this? Beyond thoughts, what is it that experiences? The answer was to come back again and again to the physical experience of the present moment, such as the sensations of tightness in the chest and queasiness in the stomach. Sometimes I could only stay with it for the duration of 3 breaths. Sometimes the experience was so strong, all I could do was to breathe the sensations into the center of the chest, while remembering all those who were suffering from the same or similar distress and wishing compassion to all of us. But staying with the what is this question eventually allowed the self-imposed prison, wall of fear, to begin to dissolve, and I was able to experience the grace and freedom of surrender. What he used to say about that. So, you know, it always strikes me, this practice is like it's incredibly simple, many ways. And when you come back to that original statement of the Buddha, which is really around that that all beings are perfect and complete, just as they are. And it's like that statement of that this world is in ourselves, and however you want to frame it, is perfect. Not perfect as compared to anything else, but it's just as it is. And our practice, as Zen people, as Buddhists, as people on the way, is to really awake to those habits and delusions, I guess, that keep us from appreciating this amazing experience that this life is. And so it really is a practice of faith in opening and eventually allowing ourselves to really die or give up, surrender totally to what's right in front of us.
So Shinko, can I ask you a question then?
Yeah.
Because you started the weekend off and I'm a bit thinking about this. I mean, we all probably have, but more and more, the planet is, people are saying, or coming to realize the planet is dying. So how does that perfection sit alongside that, and, not everyone here will agree with that, but from what I understand, it actually maybe too late,
I guess probably not too late for the planet, maybe for us.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Planet's fine.
So how's our dharma? And the planet's fine, exactly. But I mean, I'm not asking for a big statement, but it's a sort of dilemma, isn't it, really?
Mm.
Because we all have our own little climate control disasters going on in some one way or another.
Yeah. I think I once saw when Mozu Miroshi died, his ashes were at the Zen Center of LA, and people were going in and spending time in the small meditation hall, and everyone kind of was writing in the visitor's book, and Enkyo, who's a teacher at the Zen Center of New York, just wrote something. She said, Roshi, you know, you said the whole world is a single flower, and yet, which I think is a beautiful expression. It's like that, you know, just, it expresses that world of things just as they are, and yet, you know, it's like that and yet is the infinite side. You know, what we need to do, what our karma, our you know. So it's like it's for me. It's always two sides. Yes, you know, things are, and yet we need to take care of stuff because there is karma.
But also mental discipline is essential at this moment for the world. Yeah. We're going to go through a very difficult period, but it's essential that we're all ready mentally for that period.
Mm.
If we panic, our job is to not panic, is to go through and to...
Yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely. I'm not disagreeing with that point, though, which everything is perfect and complete, yet actually things require action. So both are happening. So what's going on in that little moment there where things are perfect and complete, yet we are driven to, this is seriously wrong. You know, those two things are happening at the same time.
I think, you know, in terms of practice, it's a lot of that's our own kind of question and exploration of what that is. And, you know, I guess you don't want to intellectualize it too much, especially during Sesshin, but that that we what we pay attention to over this particular period of time is kind of letting go of that need to fix it right now, which, and I think as a kind of basic foundation for our action, that's where I find the action comes from. You know, if we can touch that basic perfection, then it gives us kind of the power to make those wise decisions.
Okay. No, that's fair enough, but it needs to be framed. They need to be framed together. If you've only got the one, it's just washing out into...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's right, you know. But, you know, sometimes, as Mazumi Roshi said, he would say that the thing he always emphasised was this oneness, this duality, this unity, you know, because the thing is usually the thing we fail to see. And, you know, especially, you know, there's no... And I guess, as I'd say, especially during Sesshin, that's the thing we really... You know, that's the aspect that we're highlighting during Sesshin. And there's lots of time to go and save the world, and I'm going to do it when I get out.
It's like my childhood.
But I don't want to get too much into discussion, because raise the mind too much. But over Sesshin really is kind of letting those thoughts come up, wonderful thoughts, see them, maybe experience the activity of mind, but that's really what the Sesshin practice is around. Yeah, and then whatever thoughts you have around them, you can kind of sit with that energy. Okay, so we've got one full day to go. We'll finish around midday tomorrow. So I guess when you've kind of built up this experience, this energy, then it's at a kind of a critical time when you can really use it well. So sometimes we start to look at a little bit of hidden sesshin and start to think, well, there's only a day to go. And I start thinking about what I'm going to do. And really, since you've built up that level of concentration and settledness, that's a really good time just to build on that. Just to commit to bringing your attention and awareness back to what is directly in front. Letting go of the story and just experiencing this mind flower that's blooming right now. Okay, we finished.